Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Joyce Barry and Friends, the number one worldwide radio show. The show's outrageous and it's contagious. It will lift your spirits high, you'll feel that you can fly. Transform your attitude, fill it with gratitude. Cut loose and improvise, it's coaching time today. Joyce is a great coach with an extraordinary approach. Fast on the upbeat, top of the heap. A wild motivator, great stimulator. Unstoppable in a humoristic way. Life lessons with passion, joyfully today. You want Joyce as your coach if you want this to be your best year ever.
I want this to be your best year ever, Coach Joyce here. I want this to be my best year ever. I want this to be the best year ever for Joel Freeman, his friends, and his family. And we want this to be the best year ever for all our friends and family and loyal listeners worldwide.
Welcome to Joyce, Barry, and Friends. We are broadcasting live across America and around the world. This is the Hour to Empower, with stimulating talk, views you can use, memorable quotes, and powerful life lessons. We always have hot guests and cool topics. We even have cool guests and hot topics. You always want to tune us on, tune in, and tune up with us to hear the best of the best. You do not want to miss any of our shows. Each show goes into our archives. Log into Joyce Barry and Friends.com, Barry, B-A-R-R-I-E, and you will see each guest and each topic on our homepage. You can play and download any of our shows, always informative, inspiring, and motivational. You want to share these special shows with your friends, family, and contacts. You can follow us on Facebook and become a Joyce Barry subscriber and even a fan by going to our Joyce Barry and Friends fan page. Be sure to check like. You can follow us on Twitter. You can follow us by going to our Blog Talk Radio homepage and clicking follow right below my picture. You can also message me in any of these venues about our show, about our guests, about anything. My official website is joycebarry.com. Barry, B-A-R-R-I-E. The chat room is open. Log into the chat room, have fun, and chat away. I go back and forth into the chat room during the show to see what is going on in there. Motivation, inspiration, and an education. Positive, happy thoughts to improve your life, health, and finances. Take positive actions to create a gratifying lifestyle. Life lessons from me, your host, Joyce Barry, straight from the Coach's Corner. And then you will hear from our wonderful guest today. Folks, every day should be treated like a special day. We wish you the finest of friends, the opulence of opportunities, the magic of miracles, and the happiest of days. May this year be your best year ever.
Your best year ever. What a show we have for you today, folks. Author extraordinaire Joel Freeman is one of the foremost authorities on Black history. Of note, Joel is not Black. Joel is also an authority on the history of Israel and takes a group there every year. Of note also, Joel is not Jewish. Today, Joel celebrates Black History Month. He talks about the very special people who had major contributions to civil rights. Some you will immediately recognize and others you may not. Listen and learn from this master of Black history. Joel is a PhD. He's asked to speak all over the world on various topics: leadership, teamwork, emotional intelligence, intelligence, cultural competence, entrepreneurship, and Black history. Most people who attend his lectures and presentations are there because they have heard about his books or have watched the film Return to Glory, the book he co-wrote. They are interested in what he has to say. We are always interested in what Joel has to say. One of the few people I call a genius. However, Joel is very humble, and he may not agree to that. Just like when I say he is the foremost authority on Black history, he's had me change it to one of the foremost authorities on Black history. Someone I am most proud to call my friend, Joel Freeman. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Joyce. I'd even change that to student of Black history.
See that? That's what I mean, student of Black history.
That's the truth.
Joel, where do you want to start?
Well, I just think it's a wonderful thing to consider that we are in a time where we're able to celebrate black history and to appreciate all that has been given to us from people of African descent. And it's just it's a remarkable time to be alive, I think, and to see how we can connect even better amongst the races and generations and genders. And just I'm just really excited every day with the opportunities to connect with other people.
And Joel, let me just take a step back to the beginning. What made you have an interest in Black history? Where did that come from?
Well, it was kind of an epiphany. See, I left home when I was 17, and I hitchhiked all around the country, around North America, actually. And it was really, I guess it was by the time I was 18, a little over 18, I'd already hitchhiked 5,000 or 6,000 miles around North America. And long-haired hippie, dope-smoking fool, really was enjoying life and enjoying meeting people. And then I had an experience where it was, some would call it a conversion experience. My whole life changed, and I signed up for school. I ended up becoming a chaplain for an NBA team, and the Washington Bullets, the Wizards. I was one of the first chaplains in the history of the NBA back in the late 70s, and that was the year just after the Washington Bullets won the championship. So it was a real roller coaster. I was 25 when that happened, and I still looked like I was 16 years of age. And I began to do a talk show or TV show, and just a lot of different things happening at that particular time in my life. What happened was while I was working with the Bullets, the players, mostly of African descent, began to ask me questions. They just wanted to know, what did Jesus look like? They just wanted to know what part did people of African descent have to play in biblical and extra-biblical history. And they wanted to know all sorts of other things. And honestly, I didn't have a clue. And I didn't even know what questions to ask. So what happened is that I began to research on my own. And I wasn't even sure how to research. I just knew that this was a place to get started, and I began to read books. And then I met a friend of who's become a dear friend of mine, a gentleman. I was up in New York doing some leadership work for a company, and he was the senior HR, human resources director, of the company. And what happened is he between sessions, he's African-American, between sessions he began to share with me his journey. And his journey is that he's rather light-skinned. In fact, he could even pass as a white man. All his, the rest of his family, his parents, his siblings, his wife, his child, all are much darker hue. And he said that as a young man, he did not want to study Black history because he saw other people begin to study black history, and he saw them become very angry and frustrated. And he says, you know, as a young man, I knew I wanted to be successful in corporate America, and I knew that I had a limited amount of energy and focus. And if I were to begin to pull away from that focus by getting involved and studying and getting angry, he said, all that limited energy would be going in another direction. So he said, I just knew I had to really focus on success. Then he said he began to study about black history in his mid-30s. And when we met, he was sharing with excitement what he was learning. And some of the stuff he was learning, I'd never heard before. In fact, most of it, just about all of it. And it forced me to begin to study. And then I began to tell him, I said, you know, you ought to write a book about this. I think you're onto something. And then he came back to me a few weeks later and said, you know, I think it'd be powerful to have a white man and a black man co-write a book, which we ended up doing, Return to Glory, subtitled The Powerful Stirring of the Black Man. And then we ended up co-writing the film version, which is now in French, Portuguese, Spanish, and English subtitling. And it's been viewed by millions of people. So that really was the genesis, because when you start writing a book about something, you really have to do a deep dive, because you're putting your name on the cover, and the bibliography, you know, is there. People want to see what well you're drawing your water from. And so that's really what encouraged me. And then, of course, we're talking more with a lot of the players in the NBA, and I began to build a black history collection. My collection is now over 3,000 pieces. Oldest piece dates back to 1553. And why did I do that? It's because I wanted to have – I saw the power of the genuine artifact. You know, so if you have an actual letter, handwritten letter by Frederick Douglass, he actually touched that paper. He actually wrote on that paper. I've seen people very wealthy, very powerful, very famous people hold that letter in their hands and almost become like a little kid in front of me. And these are people that aren't awed by anything. You know, whatever pops in their mind, if they want to go golfing in Florida or go to an island and go golfing for a few hours and then come fly home, they could do that. But to be able to hold a letter, I saw the power of the real documents. It opened up doors and opened up hearts, opened up minds. So that's why I built the collection. And it's just been astonishing. Been able to do exhibits at the United Nations twice. I'm part of an exhibit that's now circling the globe, going to various countries. I think the latest count was like 44 countries now. And that's on the radar screen for this exhibit. And then exhibiting at the White House, Secret Service, FBI, Department of Justice, all kinds of places. It's just been an amazing journey to see the doors that have opened. And then going into prisons, showing the film, or talking. I have a program called A White Man's Journey into Black History. I'm just blown away by the opportunities it's afforded.
Joe, I'm blown away by you. And when I've announced on other shows that you have the largest collection of black history things, you always said one of the large. Can you now say it is the largest?
Oh, no, it's not. I know. It's a very small world. It's a tight fraternity. And I'll tell you, the people that I know of, one woman, 85 years of age in Staten Island, she owns probably, I think she stopped counting at 25,000 pieces. So it's, I'm very selective about the items I get. I pass over 200 items to get the 201st item, because I'm looking at how will this exhibit, can I add media to it? You know, for instance, I own the actual check that Pearl Bailey was paid for her part in Porgy and Bess. Why did I get that check?
Wow.
Because people,
oh,
then you can add the media of the film Porgy and Bess, some of her singing and her performance in that movie, and then say here's what she was paid in 1958. You know, for instance, you know what was she paid? Here's the amount. And I'm not going to tell people; they have to go to blackhistorycollection.com to find out how much she was paid. and then
wait, is that one of your websites? You have so many. Black
History Collection.com is the collection. or some of the collection. It's part of the collection that's up there, but they could do a word search on Pearl Bailey and find out how much she was paid for that movie. And then also I have the actual contract for the book, His Eyes on the Sparrow, by Ethel Waters. And she, that was her signature song. She was the first of many different things, opening up the door for African Americans in entertainment, in the world of entertainment, and just a remarkable person all the way around. But that's the kind of stuff I wanted to get. So you could put media around it. You could have something, you know, with the book. I own probably about 20 copies of first edition copies of the book. And then to have the contract, I can have 20 different exhibits with a reproduction of the contract and have an actual book. So it's something I think about. You know, is this scalable? And I have the first, for instance, the test pressing. I have over 100 test pressings of songs from you just pretty much name the entertainer. I have a test pressing, but I have one of Louis Armstrong, 1926, and as he sang the song "The Georgia Grind," and that was the first time he ever sang on a song. Every song prior, he played the cornet or the trumpet on that song and didn't sing. It was before he had throat surgery, which gave him that signature gravelly sound. So in 1926, the first time he sang in a song, I have the actual test pressing from that particular song. Because what they do is they create an acetate a test pressing at 78 RPM, and then they would listen to it and say, okay, thumbs up, that's a keeper. And then they would press that song and, you know, make it for mass production.
Joe, the blackhistorycollection.com sounds fascinating. Do you have any other websites regarding black history that you want to share with us now? And what books would you recommend of yours for people to read that want to know so much more?
Well, blackhistorycollection.com is one that is kind of a gateway to others, but there's one called a lot of people, when when I'm up, you know, going to speak, and let's say there's 4,000 people in the audience, and I'm pretty much the only person of Caucasian descent in the audience, and I'm up on the platform talking about black history.
There's
an elephant in the room that I have to deal with right away, and I use a lot of humor, and I have a different approach to that. But what I do is there's a cartoon bubble, a thought bubble above everybody's head is, what the heck is this white guy from Canada doing talking about black history? And so basically it's the whole idea of that website, White Man's Story, no apostrophe on the S on man's, whitemansstory.com, gives my internet version of filling the cartoon bubble, or responding to the cartoon bubble, what the heck is that white guy doing talking about or interested in black history? That's my response.
I love it, Joel. I really love it. So that's the primary one, whitemansstory.com, and the Black History Collection. That one I haven't seen, but I have seen your story, which just blows me away. So what I want to do is tap into some of the heroes of civil rights, people that made a difference, starting with the obvious people, names that our audience will recognize, and then we'll go to some that they might not recognize at all. Let's start with Rosa Parks, because she is my hero. Just picturing an ordinary person doing the extraordinary. What would you like to say about Rosa?
Well, it's interesting. I have her. I have an actual piece, a little small little piece from the bus that she sat in, and she is someone that she was kind of a nondescript person behind the scenes, just doing what she did day in and day out, and she actually had an act of defiance, and in Montgomery, Alabama. That was in December, if my memory serves me correctly, 1955. I was born in 54, and so as I remember, it was a year after I was born. December, I think it was 1955, And you know, the whole idea is that people of African descent had to sit in the back of the bus. We've all heard that, and also had to sit in the balcony of a you know, a theater, movie theater, which I always think the balcony is the coolest seats. You got the best seats in the house, I think. It's kind of crazy, but she was a seamstress at a local department store, and what happened is that she was secretary of the NAACP. I think it was the Montgomery chapter. And then what happened is that she decided that as a citizen of the country of the United States, she was tired. You know, it's like, if you're going to make me sit in the back of the bus, well, I'm not going to. I'm going to sit in the front of the bus, or I'm going to sit somewhere else on this bus other than the back. And you can just imagine, as a woman and as a person of African descent, going against a system in which, I mean, you think of a system. I look back at some of the pictures of lynchings, and it's just a horrific thing to consider. There's a crowd of people, all Caucasian, standing around with benign looks on their faces. You look over there, there's a preacher, a pastor, a reverend. You look over there, there's a judge. In the picture, you see a police officer. And you say to yourself, how is it that they could participate without the fear of retribution, could participate in watching the lynching of someone of African descent for whatever reason and not fear that there's going to be some repercussion? It's because there was a collusion amongst the various different layers of society. So you had religion involved. You had politics involved. You had economics, business involved. You had the judicial system. You had the law involved. And every single layer was in, the fix was in. And you can imagine, you know, it's just, we think of it today like, oh, she sat on another part of the bus. No, she was actually doing something that was thumbing the nose, saying, I don't care how many layers you have against me. You can lynch me, you can do whatever you want to me, but I am going to do this. I am going to take this step. And, you know, it's just a pretty powerful thing to consider when we look at the time she was in 1955 to do this. Of course, later she wrote her autobiography. She later passed away with dementia, I believe it was. I have some good friends in Chicago. That, in fact, one good friend who's a pastor in Chicago said that one day she arrived at his office and just hung out. And they talked for well over 4 hours, just hanging out, talking. I thought, oh, my goodness, I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall or just to be a part of that discussion. But she got a Congressional Gold Medal, the Spring Arm Medal, which is from NAACP. The Presidential Medal of Freedom. There's just all kinds of honors that were given to her because of that day in December when she, in 1955, when she decided she was going to defy the system.
Well, it's so impressive because she looked like, the pictures I've seen, this frail little woman just taking a stand that was so much bigger than she was, that we can even imagine. And hearing what you just said about how black people were lynched without any fear of repercussion on the part of the perpetrators. Moving along to, if I had to go back in history, one of the three people I would most love to meet, that would be Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. What would you like to share about Dr. King?
Well, the thing about him is that I find very fascinating is that he was a man of tremendous, I mean, as a young kid, he was like a prodigy. In terms of just the way that he was able to rise through the scholastic ranks. You know, Alveda King is a dear friend. That was her uncle. And she has told me some stories about just being around him as a young kid. And to be able to know that I mean, here is someone who he just was someone who came from not a very high position, you know, in life. He was an incredible student and went to college early. He was someone that achieved great things as a youngster. Now, what happens sometimes when someone achieves things rather quickly, you know, we all can look at an individual who might be an NBA star, who's an NBA star, let's say, at 20 years of age, and then they retire X number of years later. It's like, what do you do now? He was someone that, you know, just completely blew everybody away as a prodigy. And when I remember watching a video on YouTube as at 31 years of age on Face the Nation, and the way I could tell the questions that were being asked of him. In fact, I encourage everyone to go on YouTube and just put in MLK Jr., Face the Nation, and watch the poise, the dignity. I mean, I remember when I was 31, I was a bundle of insecurity, comparison, and immaturity and all the rest of it, even though I had accomplished a lot of resume obituary type stuff. But the thing is this man, it seemed like God had prepared him, even at a young age, to be able to handle the spotlight and to handle it graciously, to handle it intelligently, to handle it with poise. And when people would try to trip him up with certain questions, the way he would respond, it's just remarkable to kind of get that time stamp of his response to those questions.
That
are the kind of
things
that
impressed
me about
him. Joel? Martin Luther King Jr. on, was it YouTube?
I would say put Face the Nation and Martin Luther King Jr. I don't have it in front of me, but...
But was he on YouTube is where that would show up on Face the Nation?
I'm sure it would, yes. Yeah.
Okay, got it. I'll have to do that. He is my hero. I just want to just share just a couple of my absolutely favorite quotes. The one we all know, I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. The time is always right to do what is right. In the end, we will remember not the words of our enemies, but the silence of our friends. Nothing in all the world is more dangerous than sincere ignorance and conscientious stupidity. Our lives begin to end the day we become silent about things that matter. And finally, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. Those are some of my very favorite quotes. So anything else you want to say? I mean, you're sharing things that even with the people I really followed and know that I didn't know, like Dr. King being a prodigy.
Yes, and also, you know, I do know that he really, he was very depressed as a kid sometimes, because many times youngsters who have a high intelligence and these types of things, they many times are very melancholic, and they are individuals that behind the scenes they don't have a lot of friends. And sometimes to think of how well he was able to coalesce the people that were you know, there's no media, social media, no Twitter. I don't know of any signs that were made about the March on Washington, and yet over 250,000 people showed up on the right day at the right time. That was an incredible thing. And there are other pastors, I'm sure, that were better speakers than Martin Luther King Jr. But there was something about him. He had a why that allowed him to push through when he was put in jail. He had a why that other people would have not had. They would have maybe wanted to become famous, or they wanted to cash in some way, write a book and make money off it. But his why was pure. And so he also was influenced by Gandhi, when Gandhi was a mess himself in some ways. He was very racist in some ways, even though he accomplished a lot in India. But he went to India and was impacted by that. Dr. King also, he was someone that actually attempted suicide when he was 12 years of age. He attended a parade against his parents' wishes. His maternal grandmother suffered a fatal heart attack that day, and he blamed himself for her death. And because his six-year-old little brother, whom he was supposed to be at home watching, accidentally knocked their grandmother unconscious while sliding down the banister. And, you know, young Martin at 12 didn't know the unconsciousness was related to the heart attack. So he associated his absence with the tragic turn of events, and he attempted suicide by trying to jump from a second-story window. And so, you know, it's just the, you know, his sense of melancholy, which was perfectly understandable. It's a sign of love for his grandmother. And even though he had bouts of depression, he experienced over the philosophical divisions within the civil rights movement. You know, you had the militants and the nonviolent activists versus, you know, against each other within the civil rights movement, and the challenges of the Poor People's Campaign. But of his grandmother's death, King once said, he says, "It was after this incident for the first time that I talked at any length on the doctrine of immortality." He said, "My parents attempted to explain it to me, and I was assured that my grandmother still lived." And so even on the eve of his own death, he said, "Longevity has its place, but I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will." And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain. I've looked over. I've seen the promised land, but I may not get there with you. So I think that he had quite an awareness of his own mortality and immortality, life after, but I think that that experience with his grandmother, even though he may have understood it later, you know, that it wasn't being knocked down that knocked her unconscious and caused her to die. It was the heart attack that caused it to happen. But that just shows the sensitivity of an individual, and sometimes sensitive people can't rise to deal with pressures as he did, but he stepped outside of that and he still used his sensitivity. I think it helped to benefit him in many ways.
I find all of this fascinating. And, folks, we're going to come back in a moment. Some major contributors to civil rights that perhaps you haven't heard of. But first I want to share with you, in the words of our health guru, Beverly Nadler, why you should be listening to this show every day, and you'll find something that will impact your life, make a difference, cheer you up. Here they are, in her words, the reasons why.
Listen to me. I have something to say about a wonderful way to start your day, a way to stimulate your mind and increase your energy, make you feel so good. And guess what? It's free. Weekdays at 11 a.m. Eastern, hear the Joyce, Barry, and Friends show. You'll find it on the internet, on Blog Talk Radio. This show is upbeat and fun and very inspirational. It's informative, educational, and very motivational. There's the Coach's Corner, great quotes and news. There are suggestions, perspectives, and advice you can use to enhance your life and improve your health, plus clever, simple ways to increase your wealth. Joyce's perceptions and personality will keep you captivated, and her guests from many walks of life will always keep you fascinated. When Joyce and her friends speak, it's like you're in the conversation. This is part of what makes her show so unique, really a sensation. For Joyce's friends are not only the guests you're listening to, they're everyone who is tuning in. Yes, I do mean you. So refer your friends and family. They'll be so pleased to know. And let's make Joyce, Barry, and Friends the number one internet radio show.
And folks, we ask that you partner up with us in having that happen. Simply go to Joyce Barry, B-A-R-R-I-E, and spelled out, joycebarryandfriends.com. And on the upper left of the homepage, you will see my picture. And right on that, the simple act of clicking on follow right under the picture, you will get an email about every show, every guest, every topic. You need not miss any of our shows, because if you cannot join us when we are live at 11 a.m. Eastern, you can hear any of our shows. That's 8 years of shows in our archives, 24/7. You can download them. You can get the links and send them out to share with your friends. So do become a follower. Now back to Joel Freeman. And let's hear about some people. Perhaps we've heard the names, but we're really not quite that familiar with them, like Annie Malone.
Yes. By the way, I would really encourage folks to, with MLK, before we get into Annie Malone, is to listen to his, there's a speech that he talked about. It's called If I Had Sneezed. And just If I Had Sneezed. And it's about how he was, there was a maniacal young lady who came up to him, started talking to him, and then stabbed him. And they said that when he went to the hospital, the knife was still in there. Because, you know, if you take it out, it causes greater problems. So they left it in, and they said that it was so close to his heart that he would have died if he had sneezed. So he had this whole speech that he had given. I think it was the night before he was slain. No, I'm not sure. No, it was near there, but he had a premonition about his early demise, his early death, and this was one of them. But he said, "If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have seen this. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have seen that." And just the way that he talked about the different accomplishments that had happened, he was more amazed than anybody else at the way God had used him to do what he did so well. So I just wanted to throw that in. If I had sneezed, go on YouTube and find that speech if you can.
Wow, Joe, you're giving us a lot of homework here, but I'm really looking forward to doing my homework. When you speak, I listen, and I urge you folks out there, our loyal listeners, you should listen as well. So Annie Malone, major impact on beauty and healthcare. What can you tell us about her?
She is. I was on a show not long ago, and someone asked me, "Who is my favorite character in terms of African American history? In terms of a woman, favorite woman, and who is my favorite female?" And that's such a hard question to ask me. But I mentioned one person, and then I said, but I have to say Annie Malone is right up there, and it's impossible for me to say she is my absolute favorite, but she is becoming my absolute favorite the more I study about her. But she, Annie Malone, I was recently at an event, and I can't remember how many thousands of people were there, but I was talking about Annie Malone, and I asked the question. And I was the only white person in the audience. And I asked for a raise of hands. How many here have ever heard of Madam C.J. Walker? Almost every hand in the auditorium went up, 4,000 or 5,000 people. And then I said, okay, next question. This is not a trick question. How many people have ever heard of Annie Malone? Joyce, I would say maybe 10 hands went up. Which excites me, because now I can share something that hardly anybody knows about this person, and then begin to educate and begin to see how this can become something that can actually bring about a tremendous change in our society. So Annie Malone is the one who actually trained Madam C.J. Walker. Now, Madam C.J. Walker, it has been widely reported, was the first African-American female millionaire in the country. Now, I'm here to report that that is not correct. It was close, but not correct. It was Annie Malone. See, Annie Malone, in 1905, she actually trained Madam C.J. Walker. Madam C.J. Walker's name was Sarah Breedlove. She came from a very difficult situation in Louisiana, and she was searching for her purpose in her life. And it was so desperate, she left. And she was kind of not knowing where she was really going to go, but she heard about Poro College because she ended up there in early 1905. She learned the system. She was there for about, I would say, guesstimating, about 5-6 months or so before she moved to Denver, married Mr. Walker, and became Madam C.J. Walker ultimately. But she learned the system. Now, Annie Malone was the one who taught her, and she had grown up in Chicagoland area, and as a very early age, she'd bounced around. Her parents had passed away, and there was just some things that she had to go here and there, and she had some siblings, and she felt responsible, but she became very interested in helping other kids with their hair. And then she came up with some formulas as her aunt, I think, was a chemist, and they cooked up some formulas for straightening hair and helping with hair care and beauty. And she developed this formula and developed a cosmetic firm in St. Louis. And if you go to Poro College, that's the name of the college, that is that will tell you a lot about her history. Poro is P as in Paul, O as in Oscar, R as in Robert, O as in Oscar, ParoCollege.com. And there's some a video, there's some other things there. But what happened with Annie is that she ultimately built this up so that she had trained well over 75,000 women entrepreneurs. Now think about the time again. We're talking about the early 1920s, late teens, early 1920s. And it really was in its heyday right around 24, 25, 26, 27. Right in that period was when it was rocking and rolling. She built a huge building, 4 stories tall. And when you look at some of the pictures at that website that I put together, you'll see it looks like it was straight out of Wall Street. It's incredible. She actually created a film, which I'm right now in dialogue with some people to try to find. It's one of the there's 25 of the most important missing films, and it's number 12 on that list. And I'm trying to help locate this film. It's called Poro, P-O-R-O, Poro in Moving Pictures. And she is a 90-minute film where she actually walked people through her whole property. When there's a huge tornado in St. Louis, their property became a place where people who were their homes were torn down, blown away. They lived at Poro College. They were fed at Poro College. She was the kind of person that if she found one of the women, one of her agents, Poro agents, let's say she discovered that they had a bank account. You're saving your money? Oh my goodness! Here, and give them a cash award when she found out they had a bank account. If she found out that a woman had been able to buy a house for her and her family, she would give her a cash award. If someone stayed with her for 5 years as an agent, guess what? She'd give her a diamond ring. Now think about this. 20s. In 1926, I believe it was, she paid, imagine this, $40,000 in taxes alone. Just think about that. Even today, if you're paying $40,000 in taxes, you're pretty darn wealthy. And for her to be able to do this in 1926, she was one of the first owners of a Rolls Royce in the entire state of Missouri. And the way that she gave her money away to people quietly behind the scenes, she gave cash to Howard University. I think it's a $25 gift to that university, other HBCUs. She was constantly doing things behind the scenes, and that actually was part of the demise of her whole empire. She got married, and she was married once, and that didn't work out. She was married again. She married a Bible salesman, of all people, and she, you know, initially it seemed to work out, and then it just didn't work out at all. And he began to say, "Well, I'm married. I want to own half. You know, I want to. I'm going to bring very famous people here. I'm going to help market and brand." You know, that word wasn't around back then, perhaps, but market Poro College, and I feel I'm entitled to this. Well, it ended up in divorce, and it was a very bitter divorce. Her finance people had kind of gone in cahoots with him. They weren't paying the taxes, and what ultimately brought the whole empire down was that the IRS got involved, and it just became this huge amount of back taxes was owed. And because she was so philanthropic and gave away so much money, that was her Achilles heel. She didn't have the funds then to recover and pay the IRS because she'd given away so much money and helped so many people. She continued. I have pictures of her when she was late. I think she passed away in I think it was 1957, if my memory serves me correctly, 57, 59, right around there. But I have pictures of her in the late 40s, early 50s. And I'll tell you, Joyce, she's like she's bowed over. You know, you could just see in her body language in that still picture that she has the weight of the world on her shoulders. And I think what happened is Madam C.J. Walker became more famous because her industry, she endured in the industry, and Annie Malone got sucked down a dark hole with the IRS taxes and the divorce and all the kind of stuff, that the legal issues that swirled around her. I really encourage people to – my goal is, if I may – do you have to take a break?
No, we're fine. Go ahead.
Okay.
We're fine.
I could talk about her for a long time, but my goal – by the way, she opened up what they called the St. Louis Colored Orphans Home, which still exists today on Cottage and Good Avenue. In fact, we have you remember Chuck Berry wrote the song Johnny Be Good?
Yeah.
You ever wondered why the spelling of the word good is G-O-O-D-E? It's because
no, I never noticed
every
it.
Day he would walk by the this home, the orphan's home on Good Avenue. He was raised on Good Avenue right near where Annie Malone was. And he later on, he was not sure that his that he was going to be successful as a musician. And so he decided, well, I'm going to become a cosmetologist. I'm going to become a beauty consultant, you know, work in a beauty parlor. I'm going to work on people's hair. And because one historian said that barbershops and beauty parlors were independent businesses with a steady clientele. And so it's recession-proof. And that along with, you know, alcohol and drugs and gambling and prostitution, beauty industry, especially within the African-American community, is recession-proof. And so he felt that he wanted to become a beauty consultant or you know, work in that industry just in case his music career didn't take off. But, of course, it took off in 1958 with Johnny B. Goode. But he lived on 2520 Good Avenue for the first 5-6 years of his life. And the next block over, of course, was the orphan's home that Annie started. So you can imagine how many times he walked by the orphan's home. And later on in 86, Good Avenue was later renamed Annie Malone Drive. But what I'm thinking about with Annie Malone is I've developed a project, if you will, or a concept. I'll put it as a concept. It isn't quite a project yet because I haven't. There's some folks that are talking about making it a project, but it's a concept of a 10-year plan for the African American beauty industry to be taken back under control of African Americans. Right now, it's controlled 90% by Asians. And I'm not angry. I'm not mad at them. They've done actually an incredible job of taking over an industry, and have tried to manage it. But it's funded about 95% to 99% by African Americans, and so it just is stunning to me. It's actually crazy to me to think that here's this multi-billion-dollar industry that is controlled by another ethnicity, but funded entirely by African Americans, almost entirely. And so I have a 10-year plan from a top-down model, a bottom-up model, where Annie Malone's legacy can be reanimated, and the right people at the top, and I'm talking about having the right motivation. And I'm going to be, I don't have to be starting this or launching it or be the face of it, because it's not for me to be that person. But I can be a catalyst and help others to do this. That the right people have to be at the top, and with the right motivation. They can make money, but my belief and my purpose is that maybe 90% of the funds can be used to repair our infrastructures by providing jobs, especially to African-American youth, and especially young people of all ages. But to have people in our inner cities be able to repair the infrastructure, no government agency involved, just completely entrepreneurial. Because I don't care if it's Republicans or Democrats, they all say, oh, we need to repair our infrastructures. Nothing's going to happen through the government. It's got to be done entrepreneurially. That's my opinion, a studied opinion. And so I think it's important that this is low-hanging fruit. This is an opportunity to take what Annie Malone has done, and even though her career ended in a way that is not stellar in the sense that the IRS and everything that all brought her down, but I think we can reanimate it. And then the right people involved, and educate people at grassroots level. What I've done is in my collection, I have a diploma from Paro College. I only know of two other diplomas out there. It took me a long time to find one, and it was serendipitous in the way that I found it. Someone found me and said, I clean houses, and I clean out houses, estate. I do estate sales, and I was at a house in New Bern, South Carolina, and I found this diploma. Is it worth anything? And I said, I will pay you whatever you ask. I'll buy that from you. And I've created this reproduction straight from the original. And my dream, my goal is for every barbershop, African-American barbershop and beauty salon, to have this beautifully framed in the barbershop or the beauty salon. And guess what? That can then launch a million plus conversations. Every person that comes in could say, you know, what is that? Paro College, never heard of it before. And guess what? While the person's hair is being cut or the beauty salon, you know, all the treatment and everything, they can be, now it can launch a conversation with every single person that comes in. And guess
That's
what?
That's a very exciting project, Joel, and
it.
I really wish you well with it. I just want you to take a moment and acknowledge Frederick Douglass as well, a name many of us know but don't really know much about him. What can you share about Frederick Douglass?
Well, Frederick, people don't realize that his original, his given name was Bailey. And what happened is that he grew up, of course, in Maryland. I've been to one of the places where he grew up, and what happened is that not the exact date isn't known of his birth, but it's about 1818 or so, and then he was sent in 1826 to Hugh Ault, his family in Baltimore, and they asked in 1827 to be taught by Sophia, Hugh Ault's wife. Hugh, when he found out of it, stopped the lessons, because he felt that learning would make the slaves discontented and rebellious. Well, that's exactly true. And he hired out Edward Covey, a slave breaker, to break his spirit and to make him accept slavery. In 1836, he tried to escape from slavery, but his plot was discovered. He then worked in a Baltimore shipyard. He escaped from slavery in 1838, goes to New York City. He gets married, selects a new name, Frederick Douglass. Why did he use the word name Douglass? Because One of the abolitionists, white abolitionists in New York, said to him New Bedford, Massachusetts, said to him that he had been reading Lady of the Lake by Sir Walter Scott, and one of the characters in that story is Douglas. And so he added another S and made it his own. And then later on, what people don't know, many people don't know, is that he wrote his book, The Narratives. He named his master, and it was Thomas Auld that he named, A-U-L-D. And people told him in the North, they said, if you stay in this, if you stay here in the United States, you're going to be made as an example. And there are going to be slave catchers that are come up, like 12 Years a Slave. They're going to come up and they're going to take you back to the South, and no one will hear from you ever again. And they might even kill you. But what happened is they said, you better go to Europe. He went to Ireland. He went to Scotland. He was in Great Britain. And for 18 months, he traveled around. And I have some things in my collection from that time, from Dublin, Dundee, Scotland, and different places. Fascinating story. Finally, what happened is there were two women that gave him £500. With that, he purchased his slavery, and he ended up coming back, published his newspaper, his autobiographies, and his first time he spoke at an anti-slavery meeting, 1841, and then when he came back in 1844, I think it was, things just started taking off for him. So I just wanted to share all that because I know our time is up here, but
we're going to go over a few minutes because I would be very remiss if we didn't talk about your newest project, your new book, Grit. When do you think that'll come out? And we want to be the first to let people know it's out and it's here. What can you tell us about Grit?
Well, Grit is a 45 stories of people you probably never heard of before. And it's telling their stories using the framework of blades of grass in a concrete jungle. Concrete is a metaphor for all the horrific things that have happened, ranging from the Black Codes to Jim Crow to lynching, slave trade, everything and more. And then to be able to talk about the blades of grass, which appear by themselves easy to step on, easy to break, easy to mow down, but when you get a blade of grass, a seed of grass, under some concrete, some amazing things happen. Over a period of time, perseverance and patience through the concrete. And so the thicker the concrete, the more inspirational the story. So I lay that down as a metaphor, the groundwork for it, and then we talk about these blades of grass that came up through the concrete and the remarkable things that they accomplished. And if this first, if this becomes something that people like, I've written a number of other stories that then can make into volume 2 and volume 3. But we'll see how the first volume does. But it's just some real incredible stories, and I've got a number of books in my collection that I have access to these stories. That one book is called Men of Mark. I have two copies of that book, and it was only by subscription only that someone could get it. I'm amazed I have these two copies, but they're original editions, and so I've been able to get some of the stories from that particular book and in other sources that I have in my collection.
Joel Freeman, I'm always amazed by you. My only complaint about you, and it's a very serious, significant complaint, is I don't have you on the show more often. that's my number one and only complaint.
I can give you A+ for trying.
Yes, so I'm thrilled that you're joining us today to talk about Black history. I'm thrilled that we have you next month to talk about Jerusalem, since Trump proclaimed that it will be the capital of Israel. What message do you want to leave our folks with today that they heard your show? You're so inspiring. What would be your message?
I would say to everyone, this is something everybody can do, is to read. Read biographies of people that, especially in terms of Black history, of African descent. You know, there's a great book about of Annie Malone called The Friend of All Mankind, I think it's called, by John Whitson, I think his name is. There's another book about Harriet Tubman. Another book called Giants, which is juxtaposes Frederick Douglass Abraham Lincoln. And Abraham Lincoln was not really that sure about his interest in freeing the slaves. He didn't know what to think about it. And Frederick Douglass really influenced him. And the juxtaposition, the way they weave back and forth and the way they influence each other is just a remarkable read. So I would really encourage people to read. That's and maybe watch biographies on the Netflix or PBS or on YouTube, just to learn. Read, watch, and learn, and listen. And I think that it really helps to broaden all of our hearts so that we can become people who really want to get to know people beyond the color of the skin, to see the content of their character, as Martin Luther King said. But like St. Francis, like Augustine said back in the 4th century, seek to understand before seeking to be understood. Now, it doesn't preclude the need to be understood. It just means there's a chronological sequence. But just if everybody listening to our voices will, for the next 30 days, seek to understand before seeking to be understood, I think their world will be a much better place.
I love that closing message. And mine, in the words of Dr. King, the time is always right to do what is right. And folks, I want to leave you with this special prayer that I wrote for all of you. May yesterday be the last day, the very last day of your struggles, your suffering, your ill health, your misfortunes, your problems, your pain, your worries, your troubles, your trials and tribulations. May this be the first day. It is the first day of the rest of your life. May it be the beginning of the very best of your life, with extraordinary wishes granted and dreams coming true. Make this the most meaningful year of making more money, good health, good luck, good fortune, attracting special people and opportunities, creating magical memories, and manifesting marvelous miracles. Again, I want to thank you so much from the bottom of my heart, Joel Freeman. Always, always welcome on the show. It can never be too much. We look forward to your show on Jerusalem next month, being the capital of Israel. And folks, go out and make someone happy today. Joel Freeman made us happy today by his wise words and all that he taught us. So we invite you all to sing along with us, dance along with us, and laugh along with us. And you can do that starting right here, right now, to the Joyce Barry Mass.
I was listening to Blog Talk Radio when my ears heard something that I did know. From the speakers of my laptop I heard a voice. It was the White Oprah, also known as Joyce.
He did the MASH.
The Joyce Barry MASH.
Joyce Barry MASH.
She is a coaching smash.
He did the MASH.
You'll catch on in a flash.
He did the MASH.
The Joyce Barry MASH. I felt so inspired by her show, and her poetry was just so good, you know. I want to listen to Joyce again and again. As Joyce would say, if not now, when?
He did the MASH.
The Joyce Barry MASH.
Joyce Barry MASH.
She is a coaching smash.
He did the MASH.
You'll catch on in a flash.
He did the MASH.
The Joyce Barry MASH.
Wow.
Joyce knows all about having fun.
Wow.
She's a home business wizard and she's just begun.
Wow.
She's
wow.
a coaching sensation for not just me or
wow.
you or her. It's for everyone.
Then you can MASH.
Do the Joyce Barry MASH.
Joyce Barry MASH.
She's a home business smash.
Then you can MASH.
You'll catch on in a flash.
Then you can MASH.
Do the Joyce Barry MASH.
Wow. Wow.
Have a fantastic day.
Wow.
And listen to Joyce Barry and Friends.
Wow.